This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by the Zona Plus, a new effective non-drug treatment for high blood pressure. It's a safe, easy way to lower your blood pressure naturally. To find out more, go to tryzonanow.com or call toll-free 1-866-669-9662. Be sure to mention Dr. Hoffman and you'll get a $50 savings and free shipping. That's 1-866-669-9662. Or tryzonanow.com. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today we're going to take a deep dive into gastrointestinal health. With me is one of my favorite guests. He's visited us on many occasions. He's talked to us about immunity. He's talked to us about adrenals. He really does a marvelous job, whatever topic he's covering. And most recently, he's written a very, very interesting book for, well, it's for health professionals. Functional Strategies for the Management of Gastrointestinal Disorders, Principles and Protocols for Healthcare Professionals. But there's a lot that we can impart to you enlightened laypersons who listen to Intelligent Medicine. I know we also have a lot of healthcare professionals who are subscribers to our podcast series. Just a little background on Dr. Gwilliams. Dr. Gwilliams earned his doctorate from the Medical College of Wisconsin. He studied molecular immunology there, and he has 18 years of experience in the dietary supplement industry. He is Vice President of Scientific Affairs for Orthomolecular Products. That's one of my favorite companies that makes nutritional products for healthcare professionals to dispense to their patients and clients. Dr. Gwilliams has written several books. His most recent book is entitled Supplementing Dietary Nutrients, A Guide for Healthcare Professionals. And he's also written a popular book. Tom, what's the popular book that you've written for the public?
The Original Prescription.
Right, The Original Prescription. We also talked to him about that previously. But today our focus is gastrointestinal disorders. Now, in this very, very erudite and detailed compilation, I mean, I'm very interested in this subject myself, and I just found lots of fantastic research beautifully summarized here. You take a broader view of the gastrointestinal tract, because we can talk about, you know, IBS, and we can talk about ulcers and stomach pain and ulcerative colitis, diseases of the gastrointestinal tract, but you actually take a broader view of the GI tract as being central to a person's health. So can you, in a relatively simple way, explain that?
Yeah, so I think, you know, the GI, gastrointestinal disorders, or whatever we want to call it, you know, for thousands of years, people have realized, obviously, it's very important to somebody's overall health. And I think in our modern technology, we've gotten very good at naming diseases of the GI tract. So what I've done is I've just compiled and really enumerated, I think, what a lot of people have known and actually has been being taught in organizations that you've been in. People have been delving into these topics, so understanding that it's really the core functions of the GI tract that we need to understand, and how they, you know, when they have dysfunctions or when they are not functioning properly, they end up creating all kinds of symptomology. Sometimes we can give it a name, like you mentioned, like IBD, inflammatory bowel disease, or Crohn's disease, a subspecies, let's say, of IBD. But sometimes we don't have a good grasp on it. It's, you know, it's constipation, it's diarrhea, it's, we'll talk a little bit about IBS. It's a syndrome of something that we can't quite get our hands around. And then as we delve further, we realize that, you know, there are these basic functions of digestion and absorption. And when digestion doesn't go right, you know, all kinds of things can happen. But those symptoms may not end up being a diagnosable disease. They just might be, you know, some irritation that bothers the person after they eat certain foods, or, you know, maybe they're not able to produce enough enzymes to digest their food properly, or they're not eliminating properly. Obviously, this is a big issue of both. Not only do we see that in sort of classic elimination, am I having a bowel movement, but, you know, detoxification and the ability to eliminate, you know, certain things from the body, toxins and whatnot. Lots of things, as you well know, discussions on the gut as a place where bacteria live, the microbiome, what we call the gut microbiome. So many new discoveries on this area as far as the ability to communicate back and forth between all these perhaps trillions of bacteria. We don't even really talk about the viruses that are there, but if we just think about the bacteria, all the signals and all the metabolism and everything that goes back and forth, this is, you know, we're now discovering that this is a huge area of understanding, not only in the GI tract, but in metabolism and in brain health and all kinds of other areas. And then the other big one is just the barrier function. You know, we talk about, you know, the ability to keep things out. Well, things inside of our GI tract are technically outside of our body. So there's lots of research on not only the cells that line the stomach, and the small intestines and the large intestines, all the different types of cells that are kind of there to regulate those, that interaction in that barrier, but also the immune system that's mostly in the gut to protect us from all those things. So this book is really designed initially to teach about those core areas, how to measure their effectiveness, how to measure or how to understand sort of the signals that go on in those core areas. And then, of course, then we talk about some of the disorders that you named, IBD, IBS, and some of those things. But we do so sort of in relationship to those functions and where they go wrong.
Well, you know, I recently did an interview with the author of a biography of Eli Metchnikoff, who is a guy who won a Nobel Prize. You're well familiar with him, but some of our listeners may not be. Guy who won a Nobel Prize in, I guess it was around 1910 or so, for his discoveries about what we now call the microbiome. And he was a big believer in intestinal toxicity. So do we kind of now, a century later, hearken back to the teachings of Eli Metchnikoff and recognize that maybe he had something on the ball?
Well, you know, it's interesting, you know, a lot, it's not just this area, but when we look back, you know, Eli Metchnikoff's work and others, you know, certainly recognize that, you know, at that same time, he was learning about sort of these good microbes in the gut and elsewhere. That was sort of the antibiotic revolution or the beginning of when everyone was viewing microbes as bad. And, you know, we thought somehow if we could just kill all these microbes, we would, you know, have a, you know, aseptic environment, and we'd all be healthy. Obviously, we've learned that has not turned out to be true. Clearly, antibiotics have been helpful in a key areas of infectious disease, but what we're reaping now with the alteration of the microbiome, we could have learned from Eli Metchnikoff and others that there are, you know, many of these microbes. Of course, we didn't know that much about them back then, but they turn out to be extremely helpful to us and our function in the GI and elsewhere.
So let's talk about some of the issues that you bring up in the book. You have a very detailed discussion of replacement of hydrochloric acid, betaine hydrochloric acid, for example, also pancreatic enzymes. These are tools that natural practitioners often resort to, you know, sometimes just on a hunch. But there's real science to this, right?
So, you know, interestingly, and one of the things that I do with the series of books that I've been putting together, including this one, is really to go and investigate what is the evidence base for, you know, some of the common things that are being done within the integrative medicine community. Sometimes I find, you know, there's not so much evidence and maybe even some contrary evidence. Here we just have, when you're talking about the idea of replacing hydrochloric acid and the use of enzymes, there surprisingly is not a broad base of evidence, but there is some question that we have about when we age or as we're aging, you know, is our stomach acid getting lower and lower, and do we need to add it back? And interestingly, one of the problems with discovering that is a lot of people test these sorts of things in individuals when they're fasting. And when you just take an elderly individual or a young individual and you measure the fasting level of acid in their stomach, turns out it's very similar. And that's why a lot of reports say, well, you know, there's really no evidence that, you know, as you get older, this is a problem. But I discovered two papers done by the same group where they actually looked at the pH of the stomach after a meal. And what they found was, after a meal, young people were able to reacidify or lower the pH of their stomach and reacidify it much quicker than the older individuals. And so this is really, you know, this is where the rubber meets the road. You don't need your acid in your stomach necessarily when you're fasting. You need it when you're eating. And so I coined a phrase, which was called functional hypochlorhydria. Hypochlorhydria just means low stomach acid or low acid. So it's a functional condition, meaning it requires some sort of challenge in order to really see that. And of course, as you know, a lot of conditions in patients at fasted levels, they seem pretty close to normal. It's only when you challenge them do you see, you know, something, you know, where you see a dysfunction. So not only did I discover that that change, I also showed that in the literature that the use of betaine hydrochloride indeed does reduce the pH or acidify the stomach very quickly, and it does so over about an hour or so. The paper that I saw was actually in people taking proton pump inhibitors, which of course everybody knows will shut down acid production. And what they were trying to show is that, you know, in people with PPIs, taking proton pump inhibitors, can you give a drug? This was actually a drug study where this drug needs acid in order to absorb. And these researchers are saying, well, if everybody's on PPIs, I give them my drug, it's not going to absorb. So they showed that, sure enough, I can give you PPIs, I can give you betaine hydrochloride, and I can lower your stomach acid long enough for this drug to absorb and get in. So it's showing really two things. One, obviously betaine hydrochloride is very effective at reducing the stomach pH over, you know, a meal, certainly over a time of a meal. And number two, maybe people that are on PPIs should actually be taking betaine hydrochloride with their meal, and then after the meal, the proton pump inhibitor will kick back in and kind of protect, if you want to go that route, protect the gut from excess acid. So kind of gives a couple different avenues. And then finally, the question about, as we age, do we make less and less enzymes in our pancreas, and is that a vulnerability? As it turns out, there's an enzyme of all the different enzymes that we produce. One of them is called elastase. It's a protease. It breaks down certain types of proteins, and you can measure it actually in the stool. So you can take a stool sample and measure it, and it's a very good measure of how much of the pancreas, how much enzymes are coming out of the pancreas. And as it turns out, there's good evidence, and I show the evidence in the paper, or in the book, showing that as we age, we make less and less of this pancreatic elastase, which means we generally make less and less enzymes. And so, you know, these are, I think solid evidence sort of for the anecdotal experience of thousands of clinicians that experience and obviously patients that know when they take hydrochloric acid or they take enzymes with their meals, they get less digestive complaints and sort of this what we call dyspepsia after eating meals.
Any tips for patients in terms of selecting the proper digestive enzyme? There's so many options out there, and obviously there are different types of indigestion. Some people have difficulty with certain carbohydrates. Some people have difficulty digesting fat. Other people can't break down protein. So, what's a guide to selection of these products?
So, you know, there's two basic kinds. I mean, there are some that are actually extracted from animals, either bovine, cows, or pigs, porcine. And these are the traditional ones. They've been around for over 100 years, in fact. And we call these pancreatin, or some sort of concentration of pancreatin juice. And so those actually are probably the most suited for humans because they're very similar to the digestive enzymes that our pancreas produces. Obviously, some people may not like or want to use animal-based products. And I will say that they're not as animals and humans don't make as many enzymes that break down plants. So we're not very good at breaking down cellulose and these kind of things, fibers and whatnot. So some people actually like using plant-based enzymes. The two that most people use are from pineapple, which is called bromelain, or papaya, which is called papain. Papain is actually used in meat tenderizers. Mm-hmm. And then there are these, what we call microbe or fungal analogs. And these are a long list of enzymes which are vegetarian, obviously, or at least a non-animal. And they come from a number of different yeast or fungi or microbes, and they produce lots of different proteases and lipases, things that break down proteins and lipids, and then, like you mentioned, things that break down cellulose and all kinds of different sort of starches, and people can combine these and get kind of a more broad use of enzymes. So I basically tell people that in many ways, you should try a couple different ones. When you find one that works, obviously stick with it. But if you find one that doesn't maybe suit you, you know, maybe kind of try it a few days, maybe try increase the dose a little bit, kind of play with it a little bit. But it could be based on your diet and the way that you're eating, that you may need a different one for your style of eating and maybe suitable for you. So, you know, there's not one size fits all necessarily. I do talk about in the book that combining acid with pancreatin probably will diminish the effect of pancreatin. However, if you
so you should take them at different times. The implication is maybe take them separately.
Right. The implication would be take them at separate times. The only problem with that is they both need to be mixed with the meal. So there's really no perfect solution. You really do have to take them both with a meal. You can't like wait until the end of the meal and take one. Because you really want them mixed with the full meal. So you just have to deal with a little bit of that that diminished effect. Some people, obviously, if they use the plant-based ones, the acid is not as damaging to those because they can handle a little more acidic environment. So really it does require a little bit of mixing and matching to kind of figure out what it is that you need. And if you don't need acid, then obviously you may just want to take the digestive enzymes alone. But if you need them both, then you have to take them both together.
Okay, you've kind of reaffirmed something that I've long suspected, which is that there is a little bit of an element of trial and error to this. Different strokes for different folks, and you have to sometimes experiment because, you know, different enzymes offer different functions.
Yes, that's definitely true, and you know, the amount of one of the issues that we have in this field is that other than what's called pancreatic exocrine insufficiency, which is sort of a disease category, which is characterized by low fat absorption, there really isn't other markers of low digestion except for how the patient feels. So we're left with a little bit of empirical, you know, we're starting with an empirical test to begin with, and so we don't have other endpoints, but those are fairly good. And when people, you know, there are a lot of people that rely upon these types of products, and they know they work. So, you know, I think the evidence is justified.
Good. A popular concept these days is leaky gut syndrome, and you go into that in quite some detail. Can you explain what that is all about?
So, you know, you just had a chance to get the book. I know it's a 250-page book, so I know you haven't read the whole thing. I don't use that term that often mm-hmm. in the book. I actually prefer to use the idea of increased intestinal permeability. Not because I think leaky gut is, you know, this crazy idea, but there are some people who are overusing that term and using it primarily to promote the idea that, you know, the gut gets so leaky that, you know, wholesale bacteria are coming in without being checked or whatever. Mm-hmm. So I tend to like the idea of intestinal permeability or increased intestinal permeability. And I think what we're learning is that, as I said earlier, you know, the barrier between the outside of us, which is in this case the gut, what's inside the gut and us, is really a single layer of cells all stacked together. And all those cells are stacked together, and there are these protein linkages that we call tight junctions. And they're supposed to be there to hold together like a zipper, actually several zippers that kind of hold together. But like a Ziploc, it sort of zips together. But as it turns out, it's not a perfect seal. It's actually intended to have little pores. But these pores are supposed to be very small. Maybe the size to let some water and some very small ions through. Well, as it turns out, it's like a think about it as sort of like an architectural string where the rubber bands can pull on these and open up those pores. Well, there's lots of things that can cause those pores to open up, and a lot of those happen to be like infections or toxins or the immune system that is inflamed. These types of signals can open up the pores and allow things to get in, like toxins, bacterial toxins, or like proteins that are not fully digested, or other particles that are going to then create an immune response. Usually we would think this is going to be an inflammatory response that's going to be really negative. And so as we're learning about tight junctions and how they're regulated and all these other signals, we're learning that sure enough, this is an area where lots of different signals can come into the gut and then trigger intestinal permeability or increased intestinal permeability and drive sort of this inflammatory condition, which then can create improper immune responses, allergies, autoimmunity, chronic inflammation in the gut. And as it turns out, when you start looking at inflammatory bowel disease, especially inflammatory bowel disease, that intestinal permeability issues seem to be one of the key factors, including which also includes the fact that we have a change in the gut, what we call dysbiosis, or change in the gut bacteria, which is also related to intestinal permeability changes. So, this is an area where a lot of people are now realizing that we've sort of maybe missed it. And unfortunately, because the use of the term leaky gut, there are many clinicians that kind of scoff at that idea, that and it sort of led to sort of this lack of understanding of what really is going on at the biology.
Are there you've been involved in formulating different types of nutritional products, botanical extracts, and so on for healing leaky gut? Obviously, diet modification, probiotics play a role in normalizing that. But what are some of the ingredients that seem to have a healing effect?
So when we start talking about healing the gut barrier, obviously, there's a lot of like what not, to take out. We think of like the remove, removing things that are going to be harmful to the gut. So that's really an important aspect of it. And that we now know that there are a lot of foods that are inflammatory and they need to be taken out of the diet. Obviously anything that's allergenic, that's going to cause allergies. So that's a big component. Obviously, as you mentioned, probiotics, many of the probiotics actually stimulate tight junction, signaling that actually makes the tight junctions more tight. And then we want to, many of the botanicals that we would consider anti-inflammatory, the ones that I typically think of are things like curcumin, which is like turmeric, curcumin is the active ingredient, something called boswellia or boswellic acid, which is also known as an anti-inflammatory. A lot of flavonoids are also anti-inflammatory. And then there's others that maybe may not be as common. One that maybe you've heard of is Scutellaria biacalensis. Mm-hmm. There's a compound called biacaline. Propolis, there's actually a phenyl ester that comes from propolis, which is what bees actually get from resin, the resin of certain pine trees. So there are many of these that we think of as anti-inflammatory. And then there are agents that actually help heal the gut or actually, let's say, feed the gut itself. One that's well known by most people is glutamine. Mm-hmm. Glutamine is an amino acid, technically a non-essential amino acid, although it's essential to the tissues. And interestingly, I actually delved into the literature on this quite a bit because this was quite interesting, because probably glutamine is universally recommended by individuals. And we know lots and lots about the mechanisms of glutamine. Interestingly, we don't have a lot of human clinical trials, in fact, very few clinical trials, on glutamine in the context of leaky gut, let's say, or intestinal permeability. But that's partly due to the fact that we don't have a lot of measures, good measures. We do have one that you probably are familiar with, obviously, which would be what's called the lactulose-mannitol
test.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And basically, people drink these two carbohydrates. One absorbs readily, the other doesn't absorb unless it gets through the between the cells, and by measuring in the urine how much of lactulose, how much mannitol is there, you can kind of tell a little bit about what the barrier function is. But we do know from animal studies and lots of other mechanistic studies the benefit of glutamine in repairing and healing the gut barrier. And we do have some studies using glutamine in severe cases of intestinal permeability loss, usually in burn victims and in sort of in other situations where you have what we call critical illness areas where you have major effects on intestinal permeability. So those areas, I think, are the key ingredients that I would send people towards when they're concerned about an intestinal barrier issue.
Very good. Well, that's a good introduction to gastrointestinal physiology. That's the subject of a new publication by today's guest, Thomas Williams. It's entitled Functional Strategies for Management of Gastrointestinal Disorders. It's really designed for health professionals. Stay with us for part two. We'll tell you how to access this very fine source of information. And we got lots more to talk about. We'll talk SIBO. We'll talk Candida. We'll talk about remedies for IBS in part two of today's discussion with Dr. Thomas Williams. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.